Hello and welcome to the This Month in Forensics podcast for September 2020. I'm Phil Moore and here's a few things from the last month that I wanted to talk about. Of course, this isn't everything. The industry puts out a massive amount of content every week, so for everything that I can find, you can head over to thisweekinforensics.com. Just to start off, I wanted to just mention that the Forensics 308 class, the one that I wrote with Jason Jordan and Catherine Headley, has finished its betas and now it's on to live training. Live as in live online. We obviously aren't going to be in person, but our next class is going to be next month. It's going to be run by Jason in the Eastern time zone, what would be DFIRCon. And if you want to see all the upcoming classes for the Forensics 308 Digital Forensic Essentials class, you can go to for308.com/upcoming, and that'll show up there. It's a great class. We've put a lot of work into it to really teach people the fundamentals, which probably isn't going to be many people that are listening to this podcast right now, but you might actually have, you know, people that are starting in your agency or organization, and you want to make sure that they know that, you know, what is digital forensics, how it all fits together, and we have a lot of fun in that 6 days. So on to the show. Ladrina was on Cash Up with Jessica Hyde, which is run by Magnet Forensics, where she spoke about her experiences and her work in digital forensics and her not work in digital forensics with her powerlifting. And it was a lot of fun, obviously, seeing, I've known Ladrina for a couple of years, seeing her everywhere now. So I would highly recommend going and catching up with her on that and seeing seeing all the amazing work that she's doing there. Paraflare's digital forensics team put out a series on their blog about web shell hunting, where they walk through, you know, what is a web shell, how would you find it, with a variety of techniques. And they also released a tool that you can use called Hunter, which from memory is a PowerShell script, but I actually should have checked that before I said it. A tool that will help you try and find web shells across your web servers. They say it's a SOC-focused tool, but you in an incident response role may be looking for web shells as well. I think they also listed some other resources that might be fairly useful to read through, because I know the Australian Cybersecurity Centre and the NSA put out a fairly lengthy paper on how you might want to hunt for web shells, which is well worth the read. Brett Shavers wrote a blog post that I've added to this, and I haven't reviewed it beforehand, so I'm going to make it up as we go. Basically, the blog post was called "Should You Improve Your DFIR Skills on Your Personal Time?" And Brett basically weighs up, you know, what happens when people spend all of their time at work. To put it, I guess, to summarize it, but it's not really that simple. You know, Brett has a great post from 2018, which was called "Only Race Cars Should Burn Out." It's very valuable for people to read, especially now that you are working at home or living at work, depending on the way you want to read into that, where there is no clear delineation between home and office. What is your start of your workday? What is the end of your workday? And similarly, the expansion of your skills can creep into your personal time. I say this at 3 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon after my wife's taken my kids out for a walk so that I can have the house free to record this. And then when you finish that, you go off and do something else and something else and something else. And it's very, very easy for your professional development, the things that you want to do, to creep into your personal time and take away from your, you know, life balance. And so Brett's written a really great post. It's quite long, but, you know, the TLDR he adds at the top is you may want to consider doing your professional development in your personal time, but that doesn't mean giving up a good work-life balance. And obviously we all spend, you know, copious amounts of time at work, from, let's say, 8 to 6, and be generous, that it doesn't, you know, start before or end after, you know, 5 days a week. And then sometimes on a Saturday, sometimes on a Sunday, when do you have time to do anything else? Which means that sometimes you may have to, you know, push to your hiring manager, or not hiring manager, your manager, that you need more time for personal development, you know, professional development during work time. Because, you know, I was speaking to someone at work the other day where they were like, oh, work doesn't pay for our training, so we have to do it in a previous role. And, you know, that sounds a bit crazy to me, that, you know, people are spending their own time and money on their own professional development that is benefiting their work, who is not really taking that into account, that, you know, that they need to provide training resources to their staff, that they are encouraging their staff to do that on their own time, not on the work time. And so, yeah, Brett's covered quite a lot of ground with regards to trying to make sure that you have some personal time that is not work, that is not work related. If you would like to, and I do this, if you would like to spend some of that time doing, you know, your digital forensics professional development, your research, your training, your watching your forensic lunches and whatever else. I was just watching Lee Reber's podcast video interviews. You know, that's fine, but that should not come at the expense of actually taking a break and stepping away from the computer. And that is pretty much what I'm going to be doing at the end of this podcast, because, you know, you've just got to try and get that balance in. Abdul, sorry, I'm Abdul, I'm going to get your name messed up, so I'm going to say Abdul Al-Faifi at U0041 blog, forensics, I'm not sure, has basically taken some of the work that I did on CertUtil. CertUtil is a lol bin, living off the land binary, that is found on Windows systems, that is prolific and does a lot of things. You can use it to download files, you can use it to hash files. I'm sure there are a variety of other things you can do with it. And I was using it on a case, and I found that an attacker had actually used it to download a file, which was pretty cool. And I hadn't seen that before, and so I dove into it. And I, you know, got it to a point that I was happy with and published that post. What Abdulrahman's done is taken the file format that the metadata file that was created by the use of CertUtil and actually pulled it apart and written a parser and looked at all the different fields and what they could and couldn't mean. I think he got most of them from memory. He may have missed one or two in terms of, you know, I don't know what this means, not missed, but, you know, I don't know what this field means. But at the very least, produced a tool that says, here's everything we can do with this file, which is great because you can see, you know, when the file was downloaded, what the size was, where it was downloaded from, and it's much easier to do rather than my process, which is run strings over it, and you will see the URL, which in this case, if you process the metadata files that are found in the various locations that CertUtil will deposit them, and you see GitHub, you probably have a problem, because I think that should all be certs, and I don't think that your certs should be downloaded from anywhere other than a certificate authority. I might be wrong, but yeah, so that's something worth looking at, especially if you're, you know, devising ways of doing kind of threat hunts for suspicious and malicious activity. Another person whose name should remain unknown but goes by Atropos 416 has I can't remember when he started his blog. I might have been last month, it might have been the month before, but he's been producing some posts fairly regularly about cloud forensics and the artifacts left behind by host-based applications. It's kind of this weird, like, section you know, cross-section where you've got an endpoint application, for example, Google Drive or Dropbox, that is interacting with a cloud service. And actually, that's something that was added to the Forensics 500 class end of last year, where it's basically talking about, you know, this data technically resides on a cloud service, but it may concurrently exist on your host system. And are there logs, are there forensic artifacts that you can examine that may actually assist your investigation when you're trying to see something like data exfil, or whether a file previously existed, or whether a file was accessible or had been accessed. And so the two that came out this month that I was going to quickly briefly talk about were just about Google Drive and Dropbox and the artifacts they left behind. So if that's something that's interesting to you, and it may actually be something you don't realize that is there if you don't look for it, if you're using an automated tool that is not parsing it, or you're using a triage tool that is not collecting these artifacts, you may actually miss some key evidence. And I had a case that's not kind of related to Google Drive or Dropbox, but it was related to OneDrive, and you're able to see that the person had exfiltrated data just by, you know, copying it into their personal OneDrive and up it went. And whether that was, you know, malicious or suspicious or intentional or unintentional, that, you know, was kind of regardless, it was one of those things that's like, hey, go look at this place and you will find evidence of exfiltration that you may not have found otherwise. Alex Caithness at CCL Solution talked about the Level database, which is, you know, a different type of database to SQLite, but you're going to be seeing it quite a lot because it's one of the bases of the Electron application framework, I think is what it's called. So you'll see it in things like Chrome or Microsoft Teams or what's another one? Discord, I think, is an Electron application. A whole bunch of Electron applications that have a very defined structure that when you look at it, you'll see they all look the same on the back end. And LevelDB is one of those databases that's going to be used to store the information. So Alex pulled a whole bunch of information together and describes how that database system works. I think they're releasing a tool. I vaguely saw someone say they were releasing a LevelDB parser. I'm sorry if it is not CCL to whoever is actually releasing the parser, but something to keep an eye out for is kind of a note to myself. But yeah, that's it's good to see more research because obviously we've been kind of blessed that SQLite kind of took over and has been everywhere. And there are a few other different types, like the Realm database, for example, that are still around, that are around and being used. But LevelDB is another one that it's good to see someone doing the research into that. Something that happened that I don't honestly know a lot about, but I feel like I should mention, is the Zero Logon vulnerability. And a number of people put out a variety of blog posts. So who have I got here? Corelight, Kaspersky, Naviso, Splunk, Trunk, Trustwaves, and Yoroi. I've got have listed a bunch of different resources together about how you would detect, prevent, respond to the exploitation of the Zero Logon vulnerability, which affected domain controllers, Windows domain controllers, and could ruin your day. And so, you know, those resources could be fairly useful if you have to do any of the above: detect, prevent, respond to that vulnerability. The videos from this year's SANS DFIS Summit were uploaded to YouTube. For those that didn't attend, I was able to watch both of them, both sessions running at the same time, but it did run at 2 o'clock in the morning. Actually, I think it started at 11 p.m. my time, so I did miss some of it as I took a couple power naps in the middle. So it's always good to be able to go back and pick up some of the other talks that I didn't get to watch. There were quite a few of people that I'm friends with, so I've already gone and watched them again. But yeah, there's a lot of great information always stored in those DFIS Summit talks, so go ahead and watch those. James Smith at DFIR Madness made a bit of a splash last week after releasing a Rick and Morty themed CTF, I guess, kind of CTF. More, it's a series of disk images, a couple of disk images, memory. There was auto runs output. There was something called protected files, which I haven't looked at and I'm not sure what it is. There was a PCAP of data and a series of questions. And so everyone can go and download that data set and work through those questions. It's really cool to see someone do something like this because it is a lot of effort to just come up with the ideas and produce the data set that you would like to write questions for, because it is not a small feat. So, you know, it's highly commendable. And, you know, so another data set for someone to pick apart. Whenever people come and ask, you know, how do I get into forensics? There are so many resources, and having these data sets means that you can, you know, download it and give it a run and say, how do I detect X, Y, and Z? How do I answer this question? Because, you know, looking at some of the questions, they are questions that you will come up against in a forensic exam. So, you know, train the way you play kind of thing. You know, it's just looking quickly at some of the questions. You know, what was the initial entry vector? Was there a data breach? They're quite, you know, broad questions, but there is clearly an answer to them. And the best thing about someone having created the data set is they actually know how they did it. So you're able to test your understanding and your knowledge by saying, yeah, there was a data breach because I've seen X, Y, and Z information going out in the PCAP. And therefore, I think, you know, this is what was taken. You know, what was the malware used? You can start to refine and hone your malware identification processes. And the cool thing is by doing these, and I say this having not done it yet, but for people that have the time to do these things, is that they can say, cool, I've written this short process, this series of scripts, this series of tool command lines, I guess, that I can say, I can do a generic hunt for this malware, and I can remove all the stuff that I expect to see, and now I'm only looking at the stuff that shouldn't be there. And then when you take that to a client system or a forensic investigation, you've got a bit of backing to say, well, actually, no, I've run it here and it worked, so maybe I can use it again and it'll work again, and you can refine that process. So really cool to see that being put out there. And to finish off, speaking of CTFs, in a slightly different vein, Magnet Forensics have put out a weekly CTF, where I'm just quickly bringing it up right now. Basically, as of October 5th, there will be a question released. A question? Maybe multiple questions. I'm not sure about that. I would suggest going to the Magnet Forensics blog about this. Firstly, downloading the Android image, which I think was the Magnet User Summit, Magnet Virtual Summit Android image, and having a play with that, and then getting ready for the CTF that's kicking off on a weekly basis. And then what they said was at the end of the entire run, which I think will be in December, the highest score at the end will get a grand prize. And having won some of Magnet Forensics' grand prizes in the past, I think I've won one, maybe? Yeah, one. Which was a really, really cool backpack and a magnet Axiom license for a few months, and a water bottle and something other. I don't know. They give good prizes. So I would, you know, if you were interested in that way, I would recommend competing in that. And I think, just from flicking through this here, there are some other additional points if you do some things like sharing how you do your solutions or making custom artifacts or joining their Discord server or tagging them on their social channels and Twitter, I think, maybe. I don't know. Either way, again, as per the last point, seeing more CTFs coming out really opens up the data that is available, the training that is available, the way that people can test, the way that they do things, test their actions under pressure. So it's cool to see, you know, public companies and private citizens doing their part to help the forensics goodness overall. And that is all for my rambling for the month. Of course, this isn't everything. There was a boatload of information that came out. I think I'm going through pushing out 200 odd links a week minimum, culling it down from way up double that, if not 3 to 4 times that, culling it down. And for everything that I have found, you can head over to thisweekinforensics.com. There was so much worth reading, but I only have a limited time to talk today, so that's what I'm going to do. For those of the that have chosen to sponsor, support the podcast and the blog by Patreon, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it. For those that don't know about the Patreon, then just a quick background is, if you get a bit of value out of my work and you want to get a little bit of value back, you can head over to patreon.com and look for This Week in Forensics. There are also links, I think, at the top of the page, and it's part of this post. I should probably know where they are, but they're somewhere. For the Patreon supporters, you will get all the links that I have mentioned, as well as the time codes to make it easy for you to look up. I did have someone who reached out and said that they don't, you know, want to have a Patreon account and they would still like to support the project. There is a page on thisweekinforensics.com that provides another way to do it, which is basically via PayPal. I'm happy either way, I guess. I appreciate that person chose to reach out, and I very much appreciate everyone that chooses to support the project. It does take a little bit of time, so I am very, very thankful for that. for those that have contributed back. If you have any suggestions or recommendations, particularly about the rambling, I get it, that's fine. You can let me know on Twitter. I am at Phil Moore. Special thanks to my friend who goes by Animatic on SoundCloud for letting me use his tracks. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next month.